This half-hour segment is entitled Oil on Troubled Waters. Research credit on the following article goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, who has been sharing his excellent research with us in characteristically selfless fashion for quite some time. And one of the things that's going on in the Middle East is that the price of crude oil has been very, very low indeed. Those of us here in the San Francisco Bay Area have not seen those prices reflected at the gas pump, but what the heck, can't win them all. Dave researched the following for us from the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, March 10th. Of 1998. This article is by Robert Corzine, C-O-R-Z-I-N-E, in London. It's headlined, Falling Oil Prices Hit OPEC Producers' Hopes. It reads in part, the financial prospects of OPEC oil producers were hit again yesterday as crude prices plunged to fresh four-year lows. The bellwether Brent Blend oil futures contract for April delivery fell 61 cents to close at $12.98 a barrel in London trading, as oil markets digested weekend comments by Ali Naimi, Saudi Arabia's oil minister. In a statement published on Sunday, Mr. Naimi, N-A-I-M-I, indicated that current attempts to arrange an early emergency meeting of oil ministers from the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries was unlikely to succeed as long as other OPEC states maintained output well above their quotas. Quote, these countries should take significant and tangible steps to reduce their production, unquote, he said, again quoting, we do not want to reduce production to find that other countries, especially those who do not adhere to their quotas, flooding the market and taking our valuable customers, unquote. So again, note that the maneuvering in the Middle East takes place against the plummeting of crude oil prices. And again, I think that's basically what the situation in the Middle East is about. It's about what they refer to in Texas as the oil business. It ain't about weapons, and it ain't about starving kids, et cetera, et cetera. By the way, for those people in the so-called progressive sector who've been wringing their hands about the starving Iraqi children, how many of you really give a damn about who really killed the President of the United States? And beyond that, how many of you have made significant attempts to reduce your own petroleum consumption since the last bloodbath in 1991? Think about that before you point the accusing finger at others. Again, this isn't about starving children or weapons. It's about the oil business. Speaking of which, Dave White researched the following for us from Futures Magazine, obviously about the futures market, about the commodity market. This is from Futures Magazine's issue of February of 1998. It's by Jim Karouf, K-H-A-R-O-U-F. It's headlined, Will Saddam Deal the Oil Market a Bad Hand? Subtitled, With El Nino Warming Winter, the Asian currency crisis trimming crude demand, and OPEC ratcheting up production, the global energy outlook looks as bearish as it has in years. But Saddam Hussein still is the wild card. It reads in part, there is no question the market is growling at the energies. Supplies are up, demand is slipping, and there is little on the horizon to change the bearish mood. About the only bullish factor is Saddam Hussein. For most energy market watchers, Hussein is the one person who may create a bull market overnight by baiting a military confrontation with the United States. Or he may be the guy who sends oil prices lower still. A well-behaved Hussein means Iraq's United Nations or UN-sponsored food for crude deal will pump even more oil into an already saturated market. Adding more pressure to crude and distillate markets, Asia's economic woes are expected to slice demand amid an Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries or OPEC agreement to increase production. Further, the El Nino weather pattern is expected to warm up old man winter and stave off long rallies in heating oil and natural gas. Indeed, the energy market has been dealt a bearish hand and is beginning to read $17 for crude. The question now is, what card will Hussein play? Indeed, and again, it's about the oil business here, folks. And speaking of same, there was a very thoughtful article that appeared in the San Francisco Examiner of Sunday, February 22nd of 1998. This is an article from the London Independent. It's by Robert Fisk, F-I-S-K. It's headlined, Iraq's Oil Poses Threat to the West. Subtitled, No One is Talking About It, but It is Part of the Crisis. Once more, the United States is threatening a war with Iraq. And once more, not a single Western official is talking about oil. But oil, the very reason for Iraq's power in the Middle East, remains the unspoken element in the current crisis. Iraq is one of the world's wealthiest oil states. Before 1990, it was producing 3.2 million barrels of oil a day. Today, the entire UN sanctions program against Iraq is based upon the sale of Iraqi oil. Late Friday, the Security Council ups to $5.2 billion from $2.1 billion the amount of oil Iraq can sell to purchase food and medicine. That's just a fraction of its previous output per day. What would happen if sanctions ended? Could Iraqi President Saddam Hussein take his revenge on Kuwait by artificially lowering the price of oil? Arab oil experts have their suspicions. The Moamarer, as M-O-A-M-A-R-E-R, the quote, plot unquote, is a ubiquitous element in all Arab politics, but it's worth noting what Arab economists are asking. If Iraq was, quote, de-isolated, if full compliance with UN resolutions was granted and sanctions were lifted, would Hussein act to undercut the market? Currently, oil sells at between $13.25 and $14 a barrel. Saddam could sell at $9 a barrel just to bring the price down, unquote, an Arab statistician with pro-Iranian leanings commented last week. Quote, do you realize what that would mean? It would devalue British North Sea oil, undermine American oil production, and, much more importantly, it would destroy the huge profits which the United States stands to gain from its massive investment in Caucasian oil production, especially in Azerbaijan. So what incentive do the Americans have to lift sanctions and let Saddam off the hook? I would note that the United States and Britain stood largely isolated in the world against Saddam Hussein. And again, I think that there are many levels to the current crisis in the Middle East. I think Iraq's status as to a certain extent a proxy for what I have termed the underground Reich, literally significant elements of the Third Reich gone underground and surviving functional to this day, something that will appear to be utter madness to the uninitiated, and I can appreciate that. I would refer interested and skeptical listeners to RFA 37, a massive archive show available from Spitfire, a tape duplication service that I will tell you more about later in the program or later in the segment, for the documentation about that. Also, the miscellaneous archive show, Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. I think some of the German and Nazi connections to the various Middle Eastern nationalist movements are significant in this context, those dating back to geopolitical struggles that occurred during the turn of the 18th to the 19th to the 20th century, and that deepened during the course of World War II, anti-imperialism and anti-Zionism being anti-British and French colonialism and anti-Zionism being two of the points of commonality between some of the Arab nationalist movements and the Third Reich and its surviving elements to this day. However, I think that the geopolitics of petroleum take precedence in this particular regard. And again, I'm not discounting the significance of weapons of mass destruction. Indeed, I've evaluated some of the variables in connection with the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein has in a number of segments that are available from Spitfire. But the dominant consideration with regard to what's going on in the Middle East is the oil business, and it is one cynical pile of expletive deleted. And I think the cynicism goes all the way around, not just to Arab and American oil producers, or not just to the Saudi and American oil-producing nations, but to others as well. And perhaps we'll come back to this particular article if time permits. You heard reference in this story. In fact, because I interrupted it, the train of thought with some interpolative discussion, let me reread a couple of sections of this. The last paragraph that I read, this is not the entire article, but the last paragraph of this article reads, currently, oil sells at between $13.25 and $14 a barrel. Quote, Saddam could sell at $9 a barrel just to bring the price down, unquote, an Arab statistician with pro-Iranian leanings commented last week. Do you realize what that would mean? It would devalue British North Sea oil, undermine American oil production, and, much more important, it would destroy the huge profits which the United States stands to gain from its massive investment in Caucasian oil production, especially in Azerbaijan. So what incentive do the Americans have to lift sanctions and let Saddam off the hook? And again, I think some of the geopolitics of oil are front and center here. And I would also note that among the people whose interests in that I consider to be cynical are Saddam and the Iraqis himself and themselves. More about that later in the program. Do note, however, the observations of that one petroleum analyst with described as having pro-Iranian leanings, that if Saddam Hussein were allowed to pump a lot of oil out into the market, it could drive down the price of crude, it could devalue British North Sea oil, that perhaps accounting for some of the British stance in this context, and also undercutting the huge profits that American petroleum producers stand to gain from some of their projects in Azerbaijan. In that context, note the following. Dave White researched the following for us from the Boston Sunday Globe of March 1st, 1998. There's a very thoughtful article in the Boston Globe of 3198. It's by David Filipov, F-I-L-I-P-O-V, of the Globe staff. It's datelined Ashgabat, Turkmenistan. It's headlined, U.S. warns against pipeline going through Iran, but few listen. Subtitled, Race to Export Turkmenistan's Oil Looks to Logical Route. As the world follows the high drama involving Iraq, Washington's economic blockade against its other arch rival in the Persian Gulf, Iran, is slowly coming apart with barely a murmur. Regional powers and multinational energy corporations are racing to build pipelines from Central Asia and the Caspian Sea region, home of some of the world's second largest fossil fuel deposits after the Persian Gulf. Iran looms as one of the favored routes to get the oil and natural gas out to international markets, despite Washington's warning of sanctions against companies that invest in the Islamic State. Note this, please, and note the irony and the hypocrisy in some of the geopolitical dealings that some of the major petroleum companies are engaging in. Note that the United States is rattling sanction sabers, to coin a phrase, against companies that invest in the Islamic State. Store that away for reference as you listen to what follows. The development represents an unexpected snag in U.S. policy in the Caspian and Central Asian regions, which has encouraged the newly independent states to reduce their dependence on Moscow by building pipelines to replace the existing ones, all of which go through Russia. It is a high-stakes game that has cast a shadow on U.S.-Russian cooperation, and it may lead to dark political intrigues in the region. Skipping down. Last week, the 15-member European Union upgraded relations with Tehran. EU ministers said they would continue to press Iran over alleged support for terrorism. But the move opens the way for European companies to pursue deals with Iran. Undeterred, the Clinton administration has been trying to persuade Turkmenistan to build a pipeline across the Caspian where it would link up with a planned route that will take oil out of Azerbaijan's rich offshore fields through Georgia and Turkey to the Mediterranean. Now, again, note in that previous article from the London Independent and carried in the San Francisco Sunday Examiner of 2/22/98 that one petroleum industry observer said that if Saddam is allowed to flood the market with oil, it could drive crude down to $9 a barrel, threatening the value of British North Sea oil and also threatening the value of American investments in that part of the world with regard to fossil fuel development. And again, note that in particular, some of the potentially lucrative American investments in Azerbaijan could be threatened by Saddam Hussein's petroleum production capabilities. This last couple of paragraphs, again, as I continue. Undeterred, the Clinton administration has been trying to persuade Turkmenistan to build a pipeline across the Caspian, where it would link up with a planned route that will take oil out of Azerbaijan's rich offshore fields through Georgia and Turkey to the Mediterranean. But the route has some glaring drawbacks. For starters, it would be longer and more expensive to build than going through Iran. Washington may enjoy friendly relations with all of these countries, but Turkmenistan barely talks to Azerbaijan. Quote, this plan is further off in the future than the route through Iran and Turkey, the Turkmenistan future foreign ministry's Kebanov said. That's K-E-P-B-A-N-O-V. Unable to participate in deals involving Iran, U.S. companies in Turkmenistan have been forced to be creative. That's an interesting choice of words. Just what sort of form that creativity has taken, we're going to discuss in greater length in just a minute. Continuing, unable to participate in deals involving Iran, U.S. companies in Turkmenistan have been forced to be creative. The prize in this department goes to UNOCAL, capital U-N-O-C-A-L, the leader of a consortium to build a gas pipeline from Turkmenistan to the Indian subcontinent through Afghanistan, which has been plagued by nonstop civil war for two decades. Scott Barber, B-A-R-B-E-R, director of UNICAL's Ashgabat office, says his company had been training Afghan workers to build pipelines and is maintaining friendly ties with both the fundamentalist Taliban militia that controls most of Afghanistan and the opposition in the North. Fascinating that again, the United States and American the United States has been threatening sanctions against companies that invest in Tehran because they are, of course, the Islamic fundamentalist and terrorist-supporting state. And yet, the UNICAL consortium is maintaining very friendly relations with the Taliban militia in Afghanistan, which even the Iranians are viewing as extreme, so extreme is that basically they have at least nominally opposed the Taliban and have to a certain extent supported some of Taliban's enemies because they feel that the Taliban, an extremist Islamic fundamentalist group, are so extreme that they're discrediting Islamic fundamentalism. A fascinating detail in that particular regard. Again, it reminds me of the famous scene from Casablanca where Major Strasser orders Louis to close down Rick's Cafe, and Louis, the police chief, says, "I'm shocked to learn that there was gambling going on in this establishment." And the croupier comes up to him and says, "You're winning, sir." And again, U.S. companies, the U.S. is threatening sanctions against companies that invest in Iran, and yet the UNICAL consortium is maintaining excellent relations with the Taliban, Islamic fundamentalists, or extremists, I think they could be called, in Afghanistan. Even the Iranians view them as extremists and have been opposing them, although perhaps that has less to do with their extremism than with the cynical geopolitics of petroleum that I'm talking about. And again, that's why I have entitled this particular half-hour segment, Trouble on Oiled Waters. The relationship between UNICAL and the Taliban is discussed in a book which is going to be released very shortly. It's authored by journalist Leslie Coburn, last name C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N. It's entitled Looking for Trouble, One Woman, Six Wars, and a Revolution. It's an Anchor hardcover book, and I received a pre-publication proof, courtesy of Dave White. This book is copyrighted 1998 by Leslie Coburn. It's scheduled to be released by Anchor Books, a division of Doubleday, and its ISBN number is 0-385-48319-8. And of UNICAL and the Taliban, Leslie Coburn writes, "There is also the matter of the gas pipeline. An American oil company called UNICAL wants to lay pipeline across Afghanistan, pumping gas from Turkmenistan, one of the former Soviet republics. UNICAL has befriended the Taliban. The Taliban's peace and security will ensure profits from the pipeline. UNICAL has also had a good working relationship with the SLORC government in Burma, the military dictatorship that kept Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi locked up for 5 years. I wonder about the CIA's judgment. In territory controlled by the Taliban for the past year and a half, drug traffickers have profited handsomely from the heroin trade. Some of the world's most famous terrorists are sheltering around Jalalabad, including Osama bin Laden, last name capital B-I-N, capital L-A-D-I-N. The CIA's own analysts say bin Laden is financing Saudi bombers in Riyadh and Dharan. So it would seem the Taliban have not kept their bargain." By the way, the Nobel Peace Prize winner's name is capital A-U-N-G, capital S-A-N, capital S-U-U, capital K-Y-I, for those of you who want to be able to write that out. So again, I think that the maneuvering vis-a-vis the petroleum industry in the Middle East is extremely cynical. And again, what that's all about is the all business, as they say in Texas, and not about starving children, dying children, weapons of mass destruction, Jews versus Muslims. And I find it interesting that the UNICAL consortium is maintaining friendly relations with the Taliban, whom even the Iranians view as extremist. And again, that's a cynical and more than a little hypocritical, in my opinion. More about U.S. Petroleum companies' dealings in the former Soviet Union. Research credit on the following also goes to Dave White. This comes from the Financial Times of London of Thursday, March 12th of 1998. This is an article by Christopher Parkes, P-A-R-K-E-S, and Nancy Dunn, D-U-N-N-E, headlined, "Lukoil in Russian Deal with Conoco." Plans for a U.S.-Russian joint venture to explore a giant oil and gas field in northern Russia advanced yesterday with the signing of a memorandum of undertaking between Conoco and Lukoil, Russia's biggest oil producer. The deal, which still needs to be approved by the Moscow parliament, would open up reserves estimated at 1 billion barrels of oil and 2,000 billion cubic feet of natural gas. Conoco, a division of DuPont, said full development would have a direct and indirect impact on the Russian economy of $25 billion. Continental Oil Company, a division of DuPont, one of the largest oil companies in the world. And note also that Lukoil, the largest oil company in Russia and the former Soviet Union, is going to be dealing with Conoco. Lukoil is also a major potential player in Iraq as well. Research and translation credit on the following also goes to Dave White. This comes from Stern's issue number 9 of February 19, 1998. Stern, obviously a major and esteemed German newsweekly. This article is entitled, "It Runs on Oil and Weapons." And again, this is from Stern's issue of February 19, 1998. They were supposed to go to Baghdad to deliver relief goods, but the chartered plane with Vladimir Zhirinovsky and 30 other Duma members, Duma is the Russian parliament, was not even allowed to take off. The UN had not approved their flight. "We bring medicine and peace. The Americans bring missiles and war," roars Zhirinovsky. And again quoting, "If the UN doesn't let us fly, World War III will erupt," unquote. Then they attacked the salmon and fresh sturgeon. I like the writer here. I like his or her sense of irony. It's not stated who the author was. But I like that Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the Russian fascist, funded, by the way, in considerable measure through Gerhard Frey, the German Nazi, whose Deutsche National Zeitung and Soldaten Zeitung was the first media voice to publish the disinformation that Lee Harvey Oswald had supposedly fired at Major General Edwin Walker. That disinformation was used to paint Lee Harvey Oswald as a non-politically motivated assassin because he fired at an ultra-right winger. And again, that information was published by the Deutsche National Zeitung and Soldaten Zeitung on November 29th of 1963. That information supposedly was first disclosed to the light of day in an interview that Marina Oswald had with the FBI in early December of that same year. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out that the Deutsche National Zeitung and Soldaten Zeitung's publishing of that information obviously blows that out of the water. Again, Gerhard Frey's paper had several graduates of Josef Goebbels' propaganda ministry and several high-ranking SS officers on its editorial staff, and as evidenced in the remarkable and important recent book, The Beast Reawakens by Martin Lee, Gerhard Frey, very close to, among others, former Wehrmacht Major General Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front in World War II, whose outfit then jumped to Western intelligence at the end of World War II and became the CIA and NATO's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, and finally, the BND, the German Intelligence Service. So note here that Citizen Zhirinovsky is very much involved with the maneuvering of Lukoil in the Middle East. More about this again from Stern's issue of February 19th of 1998. "We bring medicine and peace. The Americans bring missiles and war," roars Zhirinovsky. "If the UN doesn't let us fly, World War III will erupt," unquote. Then they attack the smoked salmon and fresh sturgeon. Only one man in a fine suit keeps to himself. He doesn't give his name. He only says, "This is not the first time I've gone to Iraq," unquote. That man is the representative of the Russian oil company Lukoil. Last spring, a consortium under the guidance of Lukoil secured the rights to West Kurna 2, that's K-U-R-N-A, one of the biggest oil fields in the world. The Russians want to invest $3 billion. In all, at least $5 billion will be needed, so estimates the Iraqi oil minister. France and China are already in the starting block. In spite of the UN sanctions, the China National Petroleum Corporation has done preliminary work. Elf Aquitaine, that's a French company, wants to conclude an agreement. At the agreement signing in Baghdad, Lukoil boss Vajit Alekperov said, quote, "This is merely a first step in the return of Russian companies to Iraq," unquote. By the way, that man's name, capital W-A-G-I-T, capital A-L-E-K-P-E-R-O-W. Continuing, Moscow's diplomats push with all their might against an American attack, not just to bolster Russia's superpower status in the region. The Soviet Union was Iraq's most important trading partner, and Russia would like to establish that again. Moscow hopes that Baghdad will soon be able to settle its old debt, estimated at $20 million. A special government commission coordinates the business. After all, Iraq owns the second largest oil reserves in the world. Quote, "As soon as the embargo is lifted," says Lukoil spokesman Dmitry Dolgov, D-O-L-G-O-W, quote, We will be sending 3,000 specialists. Even now, in Baghdad's luxurious Rashid Hotel, Russian businessmen are turning door handles. In the morning, the black Mercedes limos of the Iraqi ministers will arrive for them. So again, Lukoil and one of their spokespersons, or de facto spokespersons, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, also bidding in the petroleum sweepstakes in the Middle East. And again, what that's all about there isn't weapons of mass destruction so much as the oil business, as they say in Texas. As I said at the beginning of this segment entitled Trouble on Oiled Waters, I think that the maneuvering in the Middle East is altogether cynical on all sides, and much of that cynicism belongs with Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis themselves. Last article in tonight's program, and this also research credit goes to Dave White. This is from the Sunday Telegraph of March 1st of 1998. It's an article by Philip Sherwell, S-H-E-R-W-E-L-L, entitled Iraq's Sanction Busters Thrive as Children Starve. In the squalid streets of Saddam City, goats scavenged through rubbish and ragged children survive on two plates of rice and a few vegetables a day. In the markets of central Baghdad, teachers and doctors sell their furniture, their television sets, refrigerators, even their pets to supplement salaries worth less than £5 a month. But after 7 years of strict sanctions, there is another face to Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Outside the flashy restaurants of the Jadriya district, that's J-A-D-R-I-Y-A, diners emerge from new Jaguars and BMWs in designer clothes to talk business and gossip. A packet of American breakfast cereal costs £6 in the well-stocked grocery, and a smuggled Panasonic stereo television is a snip at £900. A Benetton store even opened in Baghdad last month, its shelves piled high with clothes made in Syria. And then there is the opulent Baghdad Palace, where Saddam hosted Kofi Annan last week amid an abundance of marbled colonnades, crystal chandeliers, silk carpets, and gilded furniture. But otherwise, life goes on as normal for Iraqis. For most, that means crushing poverty, a consequence of UN sanctions maintained because of Saddam's refusal to come clean about his chemical and biological warfare programs. And skipping down, it is a different story, however, for Baghdad's nouveau riche, the wheeling and dealing merchants and middlemen who were making fortunes from legal trade and a battery of sanctions of busting businesses. Crude oil is trafficked out of the country, mainly through Iranian waters, in a huge government-approved smuggling operation. The profits are used to buy everything from hi-fis and violins to pasta and wine, which are then shipped into Iraq along the desert highways from Jordan and Syria. And just a second, I'm going to do a little bit of editing here. Skipping down. The regime smuggler-in-chief, according to what passes as the political grapevine in Baghdad, is Uday Hossein, Saddam's son. Skipping down. But there is another reason for Iraq's reluctance to increase official production to the new ceiling. It would then have no supplies to export illegally to fund the luxurious lifestyles from the elite of Jadriya and Mansour. And that concludes this particular segment, again entitled Oil or Trouble on Oiled Waters. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.